that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
In addition to targeting Muslim communities, the staunchly pro-Israel Macron has used similar repression against supporters of Palestinian rights, says Ali Abu Nima, journalist, in an article titled "Emmanuel Macron Wages War on France's Muslims." Stay tuned for more. Recently, busloads of people traveled the 400 miles from Bordeaux to Paris. They went to the French capital to rally in support of their local mosque, the fate of which is being decided by the country's Supreme Administrative Court, the Conseil d'État, which held a hearing on the matter recently. Over the last year, the administration of Emmanuel Macron has been ordering the closure of mosques across the country, all based on such vague accusations as separatism and inciting hatred against France and the Zionist regime. In reality, these collective punishments are a response to how community leaders have expressed opinions the French government does not like. It's also a patent effort by Macron, who is up for re-election this month, to win votes from racists. As part of his ongoing anti-Muslim crackdown, Macron's Interior Ministry in March ordered the closure of 6 months of the Farouk Mosque in Pessac, a Bordeaux suburb. In addition to targeting Muslim communities, the staunchly pro-Israel Macron has used similar repression against supporters of Palestinian rights. In February, he ordered the dissolution of two French-Palestine solidarity groups. Muslims and other supporters of civil rights across France have been rallying against Macron's iron fist repression. The Farouk Mosque in Pessac challenged the Macron administration in court. In late March, the administrative court in Bordeaux overturned the closure decision, calling it disproportionate and a grave and manifestly illegal violation of the freedom of religion. The unjust order issued by the administration has been suspended, Goez stated following the victory, adding the Muslims of Pessac will be able to continue to gather in dignity as the holy month of Ramadan comes. But the Macron administration appealed the Bordeaux court's ruling to Conseil d'État. Following the hearing in Paris recently, Guez expressed hope that the Conseil d'État would uphold the Bordeaux decision. A ruling is expected next week. The order to close the mosque in Pessac is not based on any alleged terrorist act, but solely on a speech the Macron government does not like. Amnesty International called the closure of CCIF a shocking move from the French government and warned that it could have a chilling effect on all people and organizations engaged in combating racism and discrimination in France. So far, the French government has not moved to close down Amnesty International, although Macron has rejected the human rights group's finding earlier this year that the Zionist regime perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid against the Palestinian people. This extreme repression is being done in a country which markets itself as a champion of free speech. Macron has defended and supported the dissemination of hateful anti-Muslim propaganda in the form of cartoons, degrading the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in the name of liberty and enlightenment and freedom of the press. Meanwhile, his government recently issued a formal protest to Russia because Moscow's embassy in Paris tweeted out a now-deleted caricature criticizing the European policies. So much for freedom of expression. Macron is facing far-right leader Marine Le Pen in the country's presidential runoff election on April 24th. The president scored 27% in the first round against 23% for Le Pen. Left-wing leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon came close to third with 22%, but that was not enough to make it to the second round. Macron's interior minister Gérald Darmanin makes little secret that the government's anti-Muslim repression is aimed at winning votes. In a February TV debate, Darmanin attacked Le Pen for being soft on Islam and of going too far in your strategy of de-demonization. Darmanin also accused Le Pen's National Rally Party, formerly the National Front, of saying Islam is not a problem. Le Pen, looking surprised at being attacked from the right, responded, "I confirm that you don't hear me attacking Islam, which is a religion like any other, and for which, because I am profoundly attached to our French values, I hope to protect the complete freedom to organize and the complete freedom to worship." There is every reason to doubt Le Pen's sincerity. Her apparent moderation is nothing more than a tactic to appeal beyond her traditional far-right base, which she must do if she has any chance of defeating Macron. But given its record, there is absolutely no reason to doubt the Macron administration's sincerity when it comes to its anti-Muslim policies.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani lanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim wa bihi nasta'in. Welcome, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity, and the topic today is Hollywood, conditioning of the subconscious mind and extermination of human rights. This is Sheikh Ali Hemani from Qom. The topic we were discussing was the Milgram's experiment. We wanted to cover up Milgram's experiment today and see how this experiment gave a new avenue to the politicians and the corporate world to dictate terms to the world, the society, particularly the children and the teenagers. Milgram conducted an experiment. The idea behind this experiment was to check, would people listen to an authoritative figure when he tells them to do something or follow something? So they followed a very simple experiment. They placed one person in a cabin, and this was the actor from Milgram's side. And then they would bring in volunteers who wanted to participate in this experiment and then would give them a questionnaire and would say that you need to ask a particular question to this person sitting in the cabin. Every time he would answer incorrectly, you are required to administer a shock to him, an electric shock to him. And they had a big unit in front of them which started the electric shock intensity from 12 volt all the way to 480 volt. And at the end, there was a big button which was marked as X in big red color. Now, the participants were instructed that every time this person gives an incorrect answer, you administer a particular volt of shock, let's say to start with 12 volt, and then the next answer that he answers incorrectly, you increase the intensity of the shock, electric shock, to 24 volts, and then go on all the way till he stops providing incorrect answers and provides only correct answers. So when the experiment started, the actor inside the room, he provided correct answers for first few questions and then started providing incorrect answers. And the participants who came in as a volunteer, he would administer a small shock of 12 volt. 12 volt is not very high intensity of shock, so it didn't really bother the person sitting in the cabin. But when the shock reached 90 watts and above, the person sitting inside started shouting, complaining that, I don't want to be part of this experiment anymore. It's hurting me. But every time he gave a wrong answer, he was administered a higher degree of shock, and this went on up to 180 volt. And this is when the person sitting in the cabin got up and started banging on the door, shouting that, let me out, let me out. I don't want to participate in this experiment anymore. This is hurting me. This is, you know, I'm burning. Please let me out. And this is where Milgram says that the outcomes of the experiment were shocking. What I thought would be that 90% of the people would refuse to administer the shock right at the beginning, even the 12-volt shock. And I thought just about 10% would agree to administer any level of shock. But to my surprise, 90% of them agreed to administer shock, and they started from 12 volt. And more than 90% of this 90% who agreed, more than 70% of them administered shock as high as 240 volts, which was extremely surprising. There were only two or three people who stopped and said, we don't want to participate in this anymore, especially when they reached 110 watts. They said, we don't want to participate in this anymore, and they left the place. So this was a big surprising finding for Milgram. However, there are more findings from this experiment. Let's take a short break, come back, and discuss those findings.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing Milgram's experiment. So what Milgram did was he placed a person in the cabin, and the volunteer who was participating in the experiment was required to administer shock to this person for every wrong answer he provided. Milgram thought that 90% of them will not participate. However, most of them participated. He also believed that most of them will not administer shock. Therefore, however, they administered the shock. But to his surprise, only few of them, a couple of them rather, three, four, or maximum five of them, refused to continue beyond 24 watts of shock. However, the others continued to a higher level. After reaching 240 watts, about 20 of them or 30 of them stopped and said, we can't go on any further. It's hurting them. They're shouting, they're crying, they're in pain. The only thing that was required was a person wearing a lab coat standing next to them. A lab coat is a doctor's coat, standing next to them, presenting himself as an experimenter, part of the team, or the innovator. And he just said one single statement. He said, "The experiment requires you to go on." And he noticed that most of the people, when they were told that the experiment requires you to go on, they would silently continue all the way till the end. So this is a huge finding for Milgram, that when an authoritative figure stands next to you and commands you that this is required to be done, even though you're against the idea, even though you don't like the idea, you continue doing that. There was another finding which disturbed Milgram, was that he noticed that some people were actually enjoying giving shock to others. He said some of them who crossed 240 degrees every time the person sitting in the cabin would shout and complain, they would giggle, they would laugh, they would try and hide their laugh and smile, and the joy that they are deriving from inflicting the shock to the person sitting in the cabin. Now, from this, we realize and we understand that Milgram, when he published the findings of his experiment, the whole world was shocked. Why? Because this is where the huge finding came in. The finding was that if you do not agree and you don't want to follow something, if an authoritative figure walks in and tells you, do this, then you silently listen to this. And this finding is extensively used in politics and in media and corporate culture. In media and corporate culture, there are lots of places where the parents tell the children that don't do this, don't do that, don't follow this, don't follow that. But children, when they see their parents as a father figure at home, on the contrary, they also see them as people who do not know much, then they don't listen to them. However, when they look at media, they look at the different programs that are being relayed on the screen, they see that these are the people who know. They are the masters of knowledge. They are the masters of technology. They are the progressive ones. They are the advanced ones compared to my parents, who've not even gone to college, who's not even been to schooling. He's just a plumber. He's just a carpenter. He's just a, you know, handyman working in a particular store or works in a particular factory, and therefore does not value him as an intelligent, smart, knowledgeable and authoritative figure. He just sees him as a dictator at home. And therefore, the youth and the teen tend to listen to Hollywood, to advertisements, to cartoons, to serials, more than they listen to their parents. Because somewhere in this cartoon, the person that they relate to the most walks into the scene, walks into the scenario, and dictates certain terms to the children, to the youth. You must have definitely heard about the subliminal messages. Inshallah, we will discuss about them in some of the next episodes. So this is where we understand that terms are being dictated to our youth and our teens through media and Hollywood. And our children, because they see them as their ideal person, because they see them as their role model, they take the terms from them, they obey them, and they follow them. Inshallah, until next time, fi amanillah, God bless you all. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Nearly 7 weeks have passed since the start of the war in Ukraine. Russia is now focusing on taking territory in the eastern regions of the country. Ukraine and Russia are building up their military forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk.
It's a very serious situation. The fact that the Russian forces are there have made significant moves, especially in the east of Ukraine and other parts, is unacceptable to the United States, and they're not prepared to negotiate. And I believe that their advice to Zelensky, talking into Biden today, to assured him of about, what was $130 million more worth of equipment, that they want them to continue fighting, to continue resisting, but they're not going to send any troops there.
Over the past weeks, Ukraine has enjoyed the support of Western powers, especially the United States. Western nations have sent different types of weapons to Ukraine worth millions of dollars. The U.S. is to announce $750 million in new military aid for Ukraine. The new military aid package would likely include military equipment such as unmanned surface vehicles, Mi-17 helicopters, howitzers, and protective equipment against possible chemical attacks. The Pentagon has hosted leaders from the top eight U.S. weapons manufacturers to discuss the industry's capacity to help arm Ukraine, even if Russia's invasion lasts as long as 2 years.
So there will be a lot more people dying because the United States is insistent, I think, that Putin's forces have to be forced out of Ukraine before this is all over. And it's not going to be happening anytime soon.
Resupplying as well as planning for a longer war were expected to be discussed at the meeting. The Pentagon has said smaller systems such as Javelin anti-tank missiles and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles have proved to be the most useful weapons. Washington and its Western allies have been shipping these weapons to Ukraine on a nearly daily basis. A partnership between Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Technologies makes the anti-tank Javelin. Raytheon manufactures the Stinger, which shoots down aircraft. Ukraine is ramping up its campaign for military aid even as the U.S. accelerates shipments of weapons to Kiev. Arms lobbyists and their underlings in Congress and the Pentagon are scrambling now to unlock more funds for the military-industrial complex to pump out weapons to Europe.
Unless there are other parties within the world community and also even within NATO to resist this type of policy, it's going to be a very long and costly war, and the cost is going to be borne by the world community, which will suffer in increasing food prices, increasing energy, increasing starvation for millions of people.
But amid the unanimous support for Ukraine, there are critical voices that have been raised against supplying weapons to Ukraine. It's argued that the money channeled to the military industry is used to fuel more bloodshed in Ukraine. Hawks in the West lobby recklessly for NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
They believe that a world empire effectively can be created, in which the United States is the fundamental maker of the rules. Now, every attempt to create an empire in the world has ended up in either failure or disaster, and they haven't learned those lessons.
That could be a direct military confrontation between Russia and Ukraine. It's also feared that a nuclear war is also becoming a possibility. A recent poll has shown that the U.S. is being drawn into an all-out war with Russia.
A new report released by Iran's Nur News website on Monday says undercover Israeli military personnel deployed to U.S. bases in the region are conducted their own missions independent of American forces present in those bases. The report says the important point about regional presence is the deployment of undercover military and intelligence agents of Israel in some regional countries that enjoy close relations with Iran. Experts believe that the main goal behind the presence of the Israeli agents in some regional countries is to spy on and collect direct information related to Iran's important bases and sensitive facilities.
It's a very dangerous precedent. What we now know is that the IDF and the Zionist regime's different intelligence units like Mossad are working within Central Command are working alongside U.S. Forces, NATO forces, and their allies, the Gulf states in the region. And they are their main focus is to control what's going on in the region and ultimately to fight against Iran. And this is a dangerous escalation. And we've seen it now over the past few years. First with the United States removal from the JCPOA, the brutal assassination of General Soleimani, and the increasing hawkish nature of U.S. foreign policy.
The report notes that although the Iranian armed forces are closely monitoring these provocative moves, for which the host countries are also responsible, the nature of these actions will increase tension and instability in the region and can lead to unpredictable conditions. It added that high-resolution documented photos are available on the presence of Israeli regime's aircraft and espionage equipment in the U.S. bases in some regional countries, which confirmed the intelligence gathered in the field on Israel's anti-Iran activities in the region. According to the new report, senior officials of countries where Israeli undercover experts have been present have been aware of the Israeli military and intelligence presence in their countries, but prefer to keep silent. The project started when Israel was transferred from the United States European Command, EUCOM, to U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, in order to enable the Tel Aviv regime to carry out its intelligence and military conspiracies in West Asia following the withdrawal of the United States from the region. While some believe the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has laid the groundwork for and provided Tel Aviv with a pretext to conduct its operations close to Iranian borders, others say the U.S. is assigning tasks to Israel to carry out in its stead in the region.
Their main focus is on Iran, and they are having in the region allies like Arab Gulf states and others who are focused on this. And secondly, it's to help the United States, who sees China as a threat because China and Iran's close ties and now their alliance is a threat to U.S. Zionist stability and their control in the region. So I think that what we see here is the move to Central Command is primarily against Iran, but also undergirding that from the United States is Iran's relationship with China.
Iran has shown that it won't stand idly by in the face of foreign aggression. The January 2020 attack on the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq housing U.S. troops is one example. Iran carried out the retaliatory missile attack in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in Baghdad. Iranian officials have, on so many occasions, noted that the Islamic Republic won't tolerate the presence of Israel in the region, highlighting the threats that the Israeli regime poses to the regional nations. Will they heed the warnings? Only time can tell.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S., so naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and military equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in Syria for its oil. Additionally, security conditions have been deteriorating in the areas under the control of U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in Syria's northern and northeastern provinces of Raqqa, Hasaka, and Deir ez-Zor.
The Assads, Hafez and Bashar al-Assad, who have been the last two presidents of Syria, have not allowed the United States or the corporations of the West to come into the country and buy up the oil companies and began allowing Shell and British Petroleum and the other major oil monopolies to come into Syria and to steal the natural resources that rightly belong to the Syrian nation, to the Syrian government and their people. And so as a result, the United States has decided, with the backing of NATO and Western European powers, that the only option at this point is either a full invasion of Syria to topple the Assad government, which would be absolutely disastrous and have horrible repercussions for the United States and the West on a geopolitical scale.
Local Syrians complain that U.S.-backed militants' constant raids have generated a state of frustration and instability, severely affecting their businesses and livelihood. Residents accuse the U.S.-sponsored militants of stealing crude oil. Local council affiliated with the militants also stand accused of financial corruption.
In the limelight.
At the core of the fear of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, "Panel Suggests Trump Knew He'd Lost the Election, Eyeing Criminal Case." Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump, time and again, discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts, and email correspondence assembled by the House committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting attorney general to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country." Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California, in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed
in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donahue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donahue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacobs's assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2, and I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday, a call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence, as he tried to persuade the vice president to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, when this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the spiritual level of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, there are three levels of fasting as explained by some of the scholars and as classified by some of the scholars. The basic level, the moral level, and the spiritual level. We have talked about the basic level in the past, and we have also discussed the moral level, right? Which is the next step of the basic level. Now, what is the spiritual level is something that we would like to discuss today. Brothers and sisters, this is the level of the exceptional people, khasul khas, as it is said. This is the fasting of the heart in which one focuses only on Almighty Allah and refrains from focusing on mundane issues of this world. Those who elevate their fast to this level have been described by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, as the guests of Allah. and those who have the honor, karama, of Allah. In his famous sermon, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, "It is the month in which you have been invited to be guests of Allah, and you have been made in it the people who have the honor of Allah." Brothers and sisters, this is huge. This is for our Urafa. This is for those elite believers, those servants of Allah who really strive and struggle. So, in addition to not carrying out those actions which invalidate one's fast, they also are very careful about their other limbs, their other parts of the body. And this third level, it takes them to a whole different world where they are so focused on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they don't even think of something other than Allah. Now, this is definitely something very difficult to achieve, but remember, it's not impossible. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the spiritual levels of fasting, right? And we said that there are three different types or levels of the classification of fasting as explained by our Urafa and Ulama of Akhlaq. And today we would like to bring a few words of dua in this blessed month of Ramadan, which will, inshallah, result in our proximity and our closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his family. Inspire us with knowledge of its virtue, veneration of its sanctity, and protection from what you have forbidden within it. O Allah, help us to fast in it by restraining our limbs from disobeying you and by employing them in that which pleases you, so that we lend not our ears to idle talk, and we don't let our eyes easily glance towards haram diversion, and so that we stretch not our hands towards the forbidden things, and stride not with our feet towards the prohibited places, and so that our bellies hold only what you have made lawful, and our tongues speak only what you have exemplified, and so that we undertake nothing but what brings us close to your reward, and pursue nothing but what protects us from your punishment. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.